So let us start. The first speaker of today is Christy Wan from University of Exeter. She is a senior lecturer there. She'll tell us about cilia motor control.
Okay, thanks very much for the introduction, and thank you to the organizers for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be back in Paris. Here, I hope you've been watching this video for a while, those of you who arrived early. So what are we looking at? So these are single-celled microorganisms, each of which is about 20 microns in length and 10 microns across. And I like to call these microscale octopuses because each cell has a single body, but eight flagella, or also known as cilia. So somehow we've made it to day two of the cell motility conference without having mentioned cilia so far. So I'm here to redress the balance. So here in the next slide, you will find some other instances, quite important instances, of where cilia occur. And this is actually throughout the human body. So for example, in your brain, in your lungs, in your airways. And these are extremely important cellular appendages that somehow row in synchrony or in metachrony in order to propel dirt and mucus out of your airways. And what's interesting is that they act as the body's first line of defense against pathogens and viruses and other such unwanted organisms. And so in this high-speed video here, we have an array of these appendages as they perform this global metachronal wave, as it's known, where individual cilia that are next to each other have a certain phase difference between them, and this executes this long-range metachronal wave. But what I didn't tell you is that this video actually comes from a single-celled organism rather than from the human, which is good for us because we can then rely on the conserved nature of these appendages in order to then sort of project our understanding of what happens in single-celled organisms to such mammalian systems that have such organelles, of which there are many. So in the lab, we'd like to study ciliated organisms or flagellated organisms. So what are some of the ways of doing this? We take inspiration from some of the literature on animal behavior, where essentially the idea is that you take your favorite organism of choice that you want to investigate, you place it inside some closed arena, and then you record for long periods of time in order to obtain long-time statistics of their behavior. So what we wanted to do is construct this kind of microfluidic chip where individual cells can then be confined inside these quasi two-dimensional traps shown here. So typically for a 10 micron sized organism with these flagella, they are essentially confined in the plane, so they're unable to swim in three dimensions. And depending on the size of the trap, we can then investigate how the organism interacts with its boundary, with its environment. So to begin with, we wanted to investigate or compare and contrast two different species of these microalgae that I showed you in the title slide. So this, just as an introduction, this is known as Chlamydomonas, which each cell has these two equal length cilia. And then the one on the bottom is the one that you've already seen. This is the Pyramonas octopus species, which has precisely eight cilia. So in terms of size, the octopus is really just about twice the size of Chlamydomonas. In terms of habitat, they're actually very different. So Chlamydomonas is a freshwater species. Meanwhile, the octopus species is a marine organism. So we're interested in comparing their behavior as a way to access how these functional differences may have arisen over the course of evolution. Just as an aside, I don't only study cilia. It turns out that we can place other kinds of organisms, in fact, any cell of the right size, inside these chambers. So this is an example of a diatom, which has no cilia and also no shape changes whatsoever, and yet it's capable of self-propelled movement. We can talk about that another time. So inside these single traps, we can place individual cells and investigate how they behave over long times, as I mentioned. So these are extremely long time, high speed recordings taken at 500 frames a second. So you can imagine how much data we had to crunch through to get these time series. And the idea here is that you have four different well sizes ranging in from 200 microns all the way down to 40 microns in which the cells are extremely confined. And on the y-axis here, essentially, you have individual cells. And this is essentially a heat map, which shows you how the speed of the organism, just as a very simple observable that we can measure, changes over the course of almost an hour. And what's immediately obvious is that actually the cell doesn't change very much over that period. And this, all these experiments were performed in red light. So as photosynthetic algae, they're actually unresponsive, so they can't really see red wavelengths, which is why we chose this illumination frequency. And then these Chlamydomonas cells are then confined inside these traps where they can navigate space, and we can measure other parameters such as mean squared displacements, etc., but I won't show you here. So for the other species I mentioned, the octopus organism, so here we can see that it has a very dramatically different style of behavior. So instead of performing continuous swimming, it actually has a very stochastic and almost excitable behavior. So if you compare these time series, you find that these heat maps show much more sporadic behavior, transitioning between these different behavioral states. So for example, if I watch this video here, the cell is was stationary, it's stationary here, and it undergoes this rapid shock event, which is analogous essentially to bacterial run and tumble, before it then enters into this kind of circulatory behavior. And this is then reflected in these long time series. So what's actually going on? So if we just take a sample time series and just overlay all of these many trajectories, and we can sample specific short time intervals within that trajectory and extract these behavioral sequences that I mentioned before. And immediately, again, if we just simply look at speed, there are immediate differences between the two species, where Chlamydomonas has this stochastic but really continuous kind of behavior. The octopus organism really undergoes these rapid excitatory events that are reminiscent of neuronal action potentials. And we can, of course, then compute the frequencies of these events, etc. But what's one of the major advantages of having long time series recordings is that we can then construct a flavor of what the cell experiences over time. So if we take any continuous track, we can then decompose space into these equal-sized grid boxes, and it's essentially a box counting exercise where you then proceed to evaluate the transition probabilities, essentially the likelihoods of transitioning from one box to another. So you build up a picture of this over time, and then you can scale this by the size of the box in order to convert from a transition rate to a true probability flux. And this is a technique that has been adopted in many other systems consisting of living organisms or living cells. So if we do this, then we encounter something quite unexpected, which is So there are two things to point out in this plot. So here, the color essentially represents the probability of residence. So this means that cells that are inside these wells have this tendency to circulate around the wall, as you saw in the videos. So there's a high probability of the cells to be near walls. And this, I think, is a fairly understood phenomenon, which has something to do with the steric interactions experienced by the cell as it interacts with the solid boundary. But what was maybe unexpected was the appearance of these chiral probability fluxes in the so-called flux space. And this is most dramatic in the smallest size traps. And this was unexpected because, according to a recent theoretical publication, a well that has no evidence of any anisotropy, so it's a perfectly circular well, should not lead to such chiral probability fluxes. And we have some ideas for why this could be, because fundamentally in the theoretical model published above, the cell has no chirality, as in it has no chirality and there's no bias in the way that the organism interacts with the boundary. So as soon as you break the symmetry in the problem, in any way really, this then lends itself to the appearance of these probability fluxes. But the point of this slide is really to show you that sometimes tracking of long-term cell motility can yield unexpected results compared to if you were just to do population-level assays. Okay, so coming back to these two species that we were comparing, they can execute a number of these distinguished behavioral states that I can classify. So for example, for Chlamydomonas, we have the standard run and tumble, but the cell actually also stops from time to time, so that's a third macro state, if you like. And for the octopus organism, these are the run, stop, and shock events that I mentioned before. And if you follow a single cell over the course of its trajectory, this is what these different states will look like from the perspective of these tracks. And of course, then we can take individual tracks and decompose them or discretize them as a sequence of numbers, essentially converting each continuous speed time series into three discrete states. So what does that tell us? That gives us a way to access essentially the behavioral network of the organism, so the motility network underlying the motility apparatus for each individual cell. So for example, in the case of Chlamydomonas, we can then compute the pairwise transition probabilities between states. And moreover, we can see how these transition probabilities change over time and also over different perturbations, et cetera. So one thing that we tested was the difference or compared the difference between cells trapped in wells illuminated in red light versus cells trapped in wells illuminated in white light. So as I mentioned, these are photosynthetic organisms. Therefore, you'd expect them to be quite sensitive to light. So if you imagine that, in the case of the the bold lines, you can see that the behavior, rather quantified in terms of state probabilities, remain pretty much constant throughout time if you're imaging in red light. And also, if you image in white light in Chlamydomonas, it's also consistent. But the difference here is the change or the switching between run and tumble behaviors. So in particular, the Chlamydomonas cell suddenly prefers to tumble a lot less in the white light. And this can be understood if you're the photosynthetic organism, and you'd like to essentially swim in a coordinated manner towards light, then white light is your signal, is your cue, and therefore by tumbling less, you can swim more effectively towards the phototactic cue. Meanwhile, the octopus species has a very different behavior. So, for example, run probability decays over time in the white light, but not in red. And also the stop probability increases dramatically, which means that you're much more likely to observe an octopus cell in its stationary state. So the take-home message from this slide is essentially that long-time statistics allows us a way to really access what is going on in terms of these transition probability states. And of course, for each organism, for each species, there is a different set of states that can be associated with it. And I just wanted to show you this slide as an example of one other distinct type of perturbation that we can apply to the system that is not light related. So in this assay, it's not really a chemotaxis assay, but we can discuss this. But the idea is that you can manipulate a cell's microenvironment in real time. And the way that we do this is, again, using a microfluidics approach, where we flood through these two independent channels, either cells or a perturbing agent, in this case, just KCL. And we can just investigate what happens if we induce spontaneous fusion of these two paired droplets. And so the boundary disappears when we deliver this perturbation, and then suddenly the behavior of the cell changes. And the advantage of this is that we're actually recording exactly what's happening while the chemical perturbation is being applied. So you don't have to wait for gradients to develop or anything like that. So this is just proof of principle, and we are, of course, planning to do much more with this. So we've demonstrated that single cells have diverse behaviors that we can try to analyze or characterize. But from the perspective of the cell itself, what exactly is happening? And so this sort of thought coincided with the first lockdown in the United Kingdom. And at that time, we really wanted, instead of going to the labs that were closed, we wanted to survey the literature and really understand cell motility from an evolutionary perspective. And so we characterized many, many different species, mostly eukaryotic organisms, that are capable of cell motility. And you can classify behavior in this sort of very simplified schematic, where on the top left here you have behaviors or motility phenotypes of these prokaryotic organisms. So here is where you will find bacteria run and tumble, and also archaeal motility. So these archaea also move with these flagella, but except they are operated via a very different mechanism, but nonetheless they are essentially rigid helices that are actuated from the boundary. Whereas the rest of this image consists of examples of behavior that are produced by single cell, mostly single cell eukaryotic organisms. And it is quite striking the diversity of behavior that can be accessed by these single cell, which almost all of which have cilia and flagella. I should just call them cilia. And then on here, this is where you have your classical eukaryotic chemotaxis and classical eukaryotic cells that are capable of gliding on surfaces. But then if you really zoom out and look at the tree of life, you'll find that different single-celled protists and things that I'm sure we'll hear about from Anu later are capable of really quite complex sequences of activity. And so in this thought process, we really try to place all of these mechanisms in the context of eukaryogenesis. So what were some of the key cellular innovations that took life really from this corner of the image all the way to this massive expansion? And you can read much more about it in our review paper here. But here I'm just going to summarize this table where you can find these comparisons between prokaryotic and eukaryotic organisms that are perhaps the most striking. And essentially there are these counterexamples in the prokaryotic world where these cells somehow behave in a way that is much more reminiscent of eukaryotic organisms. So for example, here you find these theovolum cells. So these are massive bacteria that are about 600 microns in size, and they are really capable of moving almost like a eukaryote. So then we can take all of this knowledge and really try to plot a phase diagram from it, in which it's a very simple idea where you're just mapping the size of the organism against its typical, I call it swimming, but effectively it's a motility speed. And I hope that on this diagram you can find your favorite organism. So then what's obvious is that there's a certain clustering that occurs. So here are all the eukaryotic cells that are capable of moving, but fairly slowly compared to organisms that move using appendages that are capable of rotating or beating in the case of cilia. And then there's a second dividing line, according to Peclet number, that separates the single-celled prokaryotes, such as E. coli, that access, or rather that are reliant on stochastic methods, stochastic sensing, stochastic temporal sensing, such as run and tumble dynamics, and all these slightly larger eukaryotic species, such as the Chlamydomonas cell I mentioned earlier. And these organisms have much better control over their swimming heading or direction. And this is really by virtue of two things. The first is cell size. So a small increase in cell size has a drastic difference in the in terms of the regime of physics that the cell can access. And then the second innovation that we'd like to dwell on is the emergence or evolution of cilia. So these appendages, if you think about it, have many more degrees of freedom than their bacterial counterparts. And this really gives a cell a way to access control over its own behavior and, in particular, motility. And of course, these have important consequences in terms of sensory capabilities, etc., that I won't go into. So then I wanted to mention some specific examples of how eukaryotic single cells perform this helical swimming mechanism known as helical clinotaxis. So it's well known from the literature that, as you can see from these very grainy early high-speed imaging images, so single chlamydomonas cells rotate rapidly, well, 2 hertz, around their own body axes, around their own longitudinal axes. And the authors at the time hypothesized that this rapid rotation was probably due to some stochastic asynchronies between the two flagella. But if you think about it, this cannot be, because a helical swimming mechanism requires some evidence of periodicity, whereas stochastic transitions between the two flagella are not periodic. So then we turned to the lab, first of all, to essentially grab individual cells on these micropipettes. And what we discovered was that the beat planes of these two flagella was actually tilted with respect to each other. And this tilt is exaggerated in this cartoon, but this is the raw, rather slightly image processed video, which shows this chirality in the average beat plane. So just to make this clear, these are image processed, extracted positions of these flagella waveforms. And what's happening is that over the course of each power stroke, the flagella extends outwards, so the length increases, but the mean or instantaneous beat plane of the flagella rotates counterclockwise. And then in the successive recovery stroke, this rotation is reversed. And if I just place all of these into a GIF, you can see that there is a cyclic rotation in the mean beat plane of the cell. So this means is that if I let the cell go, then the cell will actually rotate clockwise a little during each power stroke, and then rotate counterclockwise during the successive recovery stroke. But the important thing is that as long as you rotate more clockwise than you rotate counterclockwise, then on average you will observe the cell spinning clockwise around its own axes. And is that the case? So then we wanted to turn to a mathematical model, for which there are many. And this is really inspired by the observation that cells placed in a fluid seeded with particles can be imaged using this particle image velocimetry method, where we can show that, well, we didn't show this, but others have shown that the cells induced flow fields are actually well characterized by just 3 Stokesless. And with this type of idea in mind, we converted the 3 Stokesless description of a single chlamydomonas cell swimming in the plane of movement into a 3-dimensional model, where we essentially allow these planes now to rotate out of the plane. And I won't go into the details here, but you essentially allow the system to satisfy low Reynolds number, well, 0 Reynolds number equations. And here the key is that we can actually describe or simplify the complex waveform dynamics of individual flagella rotating, beating back and forth as single beads that are rotating around these circular trajectories. And the only ingredient that we need from this model, from the experiments, besides the actual scaffold geometry that we take from the data, is this value of the tilt angle, beta. So what is the beta plane that will allow us to reproduce what is observed? So if we take beta as measured from those high-speed videos I showed you, the cell actually does rotate around its own axes at the correct rotation frequency. But you might ask, well, it's not really performing helical swimming. And so the final ingredient that one needs to make the cell spin around its own axis in a helical way is to break another axis of symmetry. And this you can do in many ways, and the way that we decided to do it was by breaking the force symmetry. So essentially, if you imagine that the left flagellum produces a slightly different force from the right flagellum, then this adds this additional component that you require to not only roll around your own axes, but also to have to perform helices. And actually, these are super helical trajectories as well. And we can, of course, tune these parameters according to the degree of asymmetry between the two flagella. And this, we think, is critical to this phenomenon known as phototaxis, where cells placed in a dish, so these cells are green. So cells placed in a dish will actually phototax or move to one side if you shine a light. And also, the cell is capable of both positive and negative phototaxis, depending on the intensity and also wavelength of the illumination. So here we think, essentially, the cell has a control mechanism that is fully three-dimensional that allows it to respond in the desired way, in an almost deterministic way, to signals, which is very different from what happens in bacteria. So I don't have a huge amount of time, but I will just quickly show you what happens when you try to extend this to from more than two flagella to more than two flagella. And luckily, there's a sequence of different species of algae that essentially exhibit these different gates of motility. And these are analogous to animal gates, such as shown here. And what we'd like to test is, for example, what happens if you change nothing except the gate. And just to, in the final couple of minutes, if we take a look at different species of these quadriflagellates, as they're known, some cells will execute the so-called pronking gait, some will swim with a so-called trotting gait, and others have a certain galloping gait. And these gaits can be confirmed by just high-speed recordings of the phase relationships between the individual flagella. And then, of course, we can map how these gaits vary over the course of a cycle and understand why is it that the trotting gait is so efficient? And of course, then we turn to a model where there's a slight subtlety here in that we have to impose the gait mechanics, whereas we did not do so in the previous version of the model. And then we can quibble about the validity of this. So if you are reviewer two, please find me in the coffee break. So here are some example three-dimensional flow fields that are generated by such a swimmer. And of course, we can set them against each other in a sort of race of quadriflagellate species, and again, reproduce the experimental result that the cell, the trotting gait, is indeed the fastest. I'm running out of time, but I just wanted to show you one thing, which is that we also try to reproduce this at a larger scale, a macroscopic swimmer. So can we make a ciliate that looks like a flagellate that looks like a Chlamydomonas cell, and place it essentially in a low Reynolds number environment? And the way to do that is really looking at the scale bars here, is to increase the viscosity of the medium in a way that matches the Reynolds numbers that the cell would really experience. And so just to cut a very long story short, you can test things such as reversibility. So a robot that swims with a rigid flagellum is really unable to go anywhere. But a robot that has a hinge, which essentially breaks the temporal symmetry, is capable of net swimming. And then we can, of course, try to have multiple flagella and see what happens when you place them in these fluids and test, again, this is the plot that I wanted to get to, and again, compare the influence of gait on the propulsive efficiency, if you like. And this all matches with the theory and also with the experimental measurements. Okay, so I will skip the last slide. So the idea is that where we're going with this next is really to look at larger numbers of cilia. When you have ciliary arrays or interesting topologies of these appendages, what happens? And to what extent can individual cells or perhaps individual animals or larvae control these global coordination patterns? So with that, I will end by thanking my group and also collaborators in Cambridge and, not sorry, in Exeter and also elsewhere. And also, just in case you don't know where Exeter is, which many people apparently don't, this is where we are on the map. And so you're welcome to come and visit anytime, but let me know first. But thank you.
Thank you.